This is the Opinion Makers with award-winning columnist and analyst Ali Younes in Washington, D.C., and Ray Hanania in Chicago. Everybody in the news, Ali, has been talking about these reports that Yasser Arafat, who died in, I think it was 2004, in November 11th, that he was poisoned. And they're going to exhume his body. And I don't know, what is this all about? I mean, I've always figured he was poisoned, but do we have to do an autopsy again to confirm it?
Well, this is, this controversy erupted after Al Jazeera did, a good investigative piece about the possibility that Yasser Arafat was poisoned in 2004, and that resulted in his death, especially that no one knows how did he die, and there were a lot of speculations that Israel has had poisoned Yasser Arafat. These speculations, is not, or actually were not unfounded, given that Israel has in the past killed and assassinated many Palestinian leaders. So, Al Jazeera went on and investigated that, and they found that his clothes were laced with radioactive materials, that polonium.
Which is a common form of poisoning for, that the Russians used. Didn't they poison one of their spies radioactive poison?
Yeah, polonium-210 became famous after the Russians poisoned a former spy when he defected to the British, and they found, the British found the poison, and they're the first ones to speculate that the KGB or the Russian intelligence service poisoned them with this kind of poison. And from that, it became famous.
Now, let me ask you a question, though. Here's the thing that I always bothered me about this. I do believe the Israelis poisoned him. That terrorist, Ariel Sharon, hated him, destroyed the peace process, and wanted him killed. But Yasser Arafat was born in, August 24th, 1929. He died November 11th, 2004. We're talking about somebody who was 75 years old.
Well, I mean, there is no expiration date on age,
unless you're Palestinian and you live under the Israeli occupation.
Well, yeah, there's probably an expiration date on that. But, Yitzhak Shamir just died a few days ago. He was 96 years old.
Yeah.
So just because he was born in 1929,
right,
it does not mean he should die in 2004.
Right.
But they probably hastened, his demise and, probably killed him. But this has remained a speculation, given there's no concrete proof, and the Al Jazeera investigation raised the possibility that he was poisoned, especially finding that polonium was on his clothes. But, to me, after checking all these reports, and I found that the way Arafat died, according to the official autopsy report, that he died from a stroke. Stroke caused by infection that caused by a bleeding of unknown origin. So they could not find what caused the infection to begin with in Yasser Arafat's body, despite the Percy Hospital, the military French hospital, a regiment of investigative clinical trials and clinical tests, and that resulted in finding nothing that might have caused Arafat's death. Other than just the, die by a stroke, which is the official cause of Yasser Arafat. In addition to that, poisoning by polonium, there is an established set of symptoms that says that if you have, let's say, a kidney failure, a concentration of radioactive material in the kidneys, in the liver, in the bone marrow, that means that you were poisoned by this radioactive materials. And these were not present in Arafat's body when they did the autopsy or the test in the first place. So it does not correspond, the symptoms and the tests in Arafat, in Arafat's body at the time, with the known symptoms of poisoning by this radioactive material.
Right.
So it is a little bit confusing. Finding this material on his clothes, but they could not find it on his body at the time. So that's right. Well, why that's... they tried to exhume his body and see if there is something in his bones, on bone marrow, or in other parts in his, you know, material.
Yeah, and of course Israel denied involvement, but that doesn't mean anything. They always deny all their terrorist acts against Palestinians. They never acknowledge it. But when he died, why wasn't this investigated back then? Because, and I guess in fairness, we didn't really hear about polonium 210 until 2006, when that Russian spy, I think his name was Alexander Litvinenko, in London, he was killed when they by polonium 2010. So number one, we know it can be used as a weapon to kill somebody. And number two, you know, the only issue was that nobody really investigated the cause of his death back when it happened.
Yes, there were a lot of political considerations back then, Ray. Remember, there was a big fight between Suha Arafat, who married Yasser Arafat when he was a late age,
right,
and the PLO leadership. So this, you know, tug of war between the PLO leadership, Mahmoud Abbas and other leaders, and Suha Arafat, resulted in some sort of an agreement by whereby Suha Arafat will keep maybe tens of millions of dollars,
right,
and the PLO would just retain certain legacy of Yasser Arafat, or maybe records, or maybe the other part of the money. It is well known within the Palestinian community and in the Arab world that a lot of the PLO money, the public money of the Palestinian people, were under the name of Yasser Arafat personally,
right,
or under his friends' names.
Right.
You know, and this was problematic, and it's still a problematic issue within the Palestinian community, as to why put in the public money, the treasury of the Palestinian people, under the name of one man. And after he died, you know, Suha Arafat, you know, got a big chunk of that, as of which that it was the personal money of Yasser Arafat, and it wasn't. This leads me to suspect, you know, Suha Arafat's motives, coming out in 7 years after her husband's death and saying that she wants to preserve the legacy of Yasser Arafat. Well, where was she 7 years ago?
Well, let me ask you to explain that, because are you saying that Suha Arafat was motivated by a fight with the Palestine National Authority over what? More money?
Yes, over more money.
You think she's trying to get more money?
Well, I don't think now she was trying to get more money, because she got the money already.
Right.
But I think she is using the Al Jazeera investigation, and Al Jazeera was using Suha Arafat. You know, I don't know why they put Suha Arafat in the investigation.
Well,
so to me,
she was the wife.
Well, Kennedy. When Kennedy got assassinated, they didn't highlight Jackie Kennedy in the investigation, the Church Commission in the Congress.
Well, but John F. Kennedy wasn't held hostage by the Israeli military, in a room. You know, I mean, there were very few people that were close to Arafat at the time.
Suha was not very close to him. Suha was nowhere to be found with, you know.
But
imagine,
she does have all his clothes. I mean, wasn't it his clothes that she presented to Al Jazeera, that they had, I think it was Swiss, you know, scientists that checked and discovered the polonium 210 on his clothing? I mean, she had to provide the clothing.
Yes, well, because when Arafat, he died in Paris, and she was living in Paris, and of course, because she is, you know, legally the next of kin to Yasser Arafat, you know, she is legally, you know, has to have his personal belongings.
Right, now, and her permission to exhume the body.
Yeah, of course, her permission, you know, that's a legal technicality.
Right.
But, you know, Arafat being a public figure, a leader of the PLO, leader of the Palestinian National Authority, so he was not just, you know, a private person that would justify utilizing Suha Arafat's permission in this public investigation. I think we owe it to the Palestinian people to find the truth. And I think Suha Arafat, given her history, that she never lived in Gaza, really. So for Suha Arafat to come out now, I think she's motivated by, of course, Al Jazeera investigation. If there wasn't an investigation by Al Jazeera, we will never hear from Suha Arafat.
Yeah, but why make Suha Arafat the issue? And what prompted Al Jazeera to look at it today? I mean, we're talking, you know, 8 years later.
Well, Al Jazeera, this investigative report has been in the making for probably a year or more. But I think the considerations, because they were overriding news considerations, the Arab revolts, of course, they put this, you know, in the back burner. But I'm not making the issue that Soha Arafat is the main issue here. But I, you know, I just have a problem when this investigation highlights Soha Arafat more than the Yasser Arafat himself. So in other words, the investigation, the report, is making Soha Arafat the centerpiece of the report, to getting her permission. She's the outspoken about the preserving Yasser Arafat legacy, and she's the one who says, well, his daughter this, his daughter that. You know, I think as Arab people or Palestinians or any kind of Arab nationality, we should stay away from hero worship. You know, having said that, we owe it to Yasser Arafat and to the Palestinian people to find out the truth about whether he was killed and assassinated by the Israelis or not. This is what we should focus on,
right?
You know, bring it about.
But she did. I mean,
to be quite honest with you, she should be investigated for the tens of millions of dollars she was reported taken from the PLO treasury.
I don't agree. I think that Soha Arafat and Yasser Arafat, to me, is a hero and always will be a hero. And he was the only successful Palestinian to succeed in bringing Palestinians out of the abyss. The only success we've ever seen as people is because of Yasser Arafat. So for me, I mean, if he married Soha, and if she has money, she deserves it, and he deserves it. That, I mean, that's my feeling. But when I look at her comments about this, she says that we should investigate and I think what she's doing is the issue of Arafat's, the cause of his death, was never resolved or fully addressed. It was explored. The Israelis, in their most vicious, typical, you know, slander campaign, said he died of AIDS, said he was a sexual deviant. You know, they're just ugly viciousness, so you can't believe anything the Israelis say. But Soha argued that, you know, Arafat had a great legacy, and until the issue of how he died is resolved, you know, how do we as Palestinians, you know, honor that legacy without resolving that one issue? I think she's right.
Well, I know. I mean, of course, she's not telling us anything new, that Arafat's legacy, and you highlighted that he was a hero. And I wrote a column in 2005, published in USA Today and other regional newspapers, about the legacy of Yasser Arafat and how much he means to a lot within the Palestinian community as a hero, of course,
right.
And not so much for the Israelis and to the Western audience, but nevertheless, he was a hero to the people, and he accomplished a lot for them. But having said that, of course, you know, we should also, a man's legacy should be judged by his accomplishments, and Arafat has accomplished a lot. But in the later years, you know, the Oslo Agreement, you know, many people disagree that what he did was wrong, because the essence of Oslo Agreement in 1994 would make the PLO essentially a policeman for the Israelis under the West Bank being occupied and Gaza still being occupied at the time.
Well, but that's a different debate, isn't it? I mean,
it is. It is a different debate. But what I'm saying is that for Soha Arafat to come and say on TV she wants to preserve Yasser Arafat's legacy, you know, Soha Arafat is not known to be a fighter for the Palestinian cause, unlike, for example, Khalil al-Wazir's wife, Intisar al-Wazir, who after the assassination of her husband in 1986 in Tunisia, was the second man in command of the PLO. She went back to the Palestinian territories. She ran for the Palestinian National Council, and she is active within the Palestinian community. So Arafat is nowhere to be found. She became more blonde. She lives in Paris.
Okay,
why make it about
Soha Arafat? Why add to the Israeli viciousness against the Palestinians? And, you know, I mean, really, Soha Arafat is insignificant. And these rumors about Arafat stealing billions, I mean, look at how she lives. If they stole billions, I'm telling you, she must be the most excessive spender I've ever met, because she does live in a modest place, you know, in France, And it's devoid of any of the luxury that we see of our typical kings and monarchs and dictators in the Middle East.
Well, no one is saying that she stole billions. You know, Arafat didn't have billions of dollars, obviously. But what I am saying is there's a corruption within the PLO leadership.
There's a corruption in all politics, though. There's a corruption in Hamas. How much money does Hamas have? Do we get an accounting of the money that they collect, you know, from the people? We get nothing.
Right, but we agree that there's corruption everywhere.
Yes.
But should we agree with that corruption?
No, we shouldn't. But at the same time, let's not make it an issue, you know, about Yasser Arafat's death. Here's the fact. Israel murdered Yasser Arafat. There's no doubt in my mind that Ariel Sharon, one of the biggest war criminals of our time, had Arafat murdered. There's no doubt in my mind about it. And I think this Polonium 210 is a good, you know, don't you think, a good piece of evidence that, in fact, that's true. For the first time, now we have a real theory. Nobody could figure out what it was that killed Arafat. Now we know that maybe it was Polonium 210.
Maybe. I think Polonium 210 was a smokescreen. In other words, they probably killed him by still secretive type of poison that is hard to detect in the body.
Right.
And they probably spray this polonium as to throw off the investigation.
But I don't know, would it throw off the investigation? It would make it more likely, though, wouldn't it?
Well, it throw off the investigation to a different direction because you find it all over his body, you find it all over his clothes. Well, short of finding this polonium in his body, you know, this investigation, you know, what about if once they exhume his body?
Right.
And they found there's no polonium in the
bone. Well, then that would end that. I mean, you know, obviously, but it's not easy to eliminate radioactive traces. If it's in his body, it's in his body. My guess is, though, Allie, I just think if it's on his clothes, I'll bet any amount of money that it's on his body. If it's not on his body, then you're right. Then we're back to square one, though.
The symptoms of the poisoning by this material,
right?
They do not correspond with Arafat's symptoms.
But we only have one major case of that polonium 210 poisoning that happened several years later after Arafat died.
Well, actually, there were many cases of polonium poisoning. One was one of the Curie's daughters who invented that, discovered that material. She died of polonium poisoning because after one of the tubes exploded in her lab, and she died a few years later with cancer. Some Israeli scientists, actually in the 50s and the 60s, also died of polonium poisoning when a mistake was made in the lab, and they died with cancer and leukemia. Those are documented cases. I highlighted them on my Facebook page. And there were other cases of death by polonium, and they were all documented in the past, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 years. And they all were... They all died by cancer, leukemia, high concentration of this material in the kidneys, in the liver, and in the bone marrow. Now, they couldn't find any of that in Arafat's body at the time when he was sick. So this, you know, leads me to think that there is something other than polonium that causes death, while the polonium could be a factor in his death, but not the cause of his death.
But do you agree that we need to resolve this? You know, as we need to resolve this because it will help us in terms of determining the truth of whether we can make peace with the Israelis. You know, I mean, we need to know exactly what happened to Yasser Arafat. Just like Ariel Sharon is still on his deathbed, or refusing to die, in a coma, and he's been there for years, and it's still important. And you know, I think that issues of how someone is killed or dies, like Yasser Arafat, I think we need to get to the bottom of it. Regardless of what prompted this, I think this reminds us that it was never resolved and it should be.
Yes, and I you know, you're right, and we need to get to the bottom of this. But I think there will be political considerations because the PLO or the Palestinian National Authority, they will be pressed. If they go too hard on this, in other words, they want to threaten the Israelis that they will suspend any kind of peace talks unless, right, you know, something happened with this investigation. They will be pressured by the U.S. and the Israelis. They will say, hey, look, do not make a big deal out of it. You know, otherwise, we'll cut off funding to you, or will increase this, you know, settlement or this pressure or that pressure. So political pressure, they will not go forward with that. Similar to what happened when, you know, the judge, South African judge, the report that investigated.
Right, the Gaza massacres.
Yeah, the war crimes in Gaza. Goldstone report.
Right.
You know, the PLO, the PNA, you know, they did not go forward with the UN, you know, war crime tribunal to press charges against
Israel.
Well,
they can't. They can't until they have some statehood recognition. I mean, they have to have that. That's one reason why, and maybe this is for another topic for us to discuss, but that's why I think the Palestinians should go for even partial statehood recognition by the UN, because it'll open the door to bringing charges against Israel and Sharon and other Israeli military people for war crimes, you know, before The Hague. That's the only way they could do that.
That's true, given that, you know, the Arab world is now in, you know, is shattering. You know, the old regimes are on the way out. The new regimes are in. So it will be 10, 20 years before we see stability and some kind of democracy in the Arab world that will actually help the Palestinian people,
right,
you know, in their quest for statehood and for stabilization with their relation with Israel. In other words, that I cannot see a Palestinian state forming in the West Bank and Gaza, being strong and able to defend itself if there is no strong Arab world to support it. In other words,
right,
to provide a counterbalance to the Israeli power.
Right.
Now, Israel is a superpower in the Middle East, and there is no other counterbalance to that as it was Egypt before during Abdel Nasser.
Right.
That would, you know, pressure Israel to give, you know, to come down a little bit, to concede, to have some concessions for the Palestinians as far as ending the settlement project in the Palestinian territories, you know, ending the occupation once for all, and establish a contiguous Palestinian state. So it'll be a long time before this happens, you know, given that how weak the Palestinian Authority is.
Right. Well, listen, let's go back just on a final note on Arafat, and then I want to talk about the death of Anthony Shadid, another death that I think is uncertain. And then, of course, we want to talk about the Jordanian TV show where the member of parliament in Jordan and activists got into a fight. But just on a final note on Arafat, you know, the media often talks about how the Arabs, their rhetoric is hate-filled and, you know, extremist and ugly and anti-Semitic and vicious. And they go, oh, the poor Israelis were always so respectful. Yet the truth is that the Israelis are the more vicious of when it comes to rhetoric. Like this column on the Times of Israel, where I happen to write a blog, this column by Lenny Ben-David. He's a public affairs consultant. He was deputy chief of Israel's embassy in Washington. And the viciousness of the way that Israelis hate Arafat comes out in his column. It's the most vicious. It's anti-Semitic, you know, almost, in how ugly, you know, the rhetoric is. Why do the Israelis tolerate that kind of rhetoric? And if they really are so genuinely in favor of peace, I don't understand it.
Well, of course, the Israelis have better PR machine, better access to international media. So there's a lot of, you know, of course, voices within Israel. You know, some, you know, voices come across as voice of reason. Some comes across as, you know, vicious, like this, you know, Ben-David guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's just
like
ugly. I mean,
yes.
He talks about how he says Arafat, you know, mowed down thousands of Israelis. What about the tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians and thousands of children, you know, that the Israelis have mowed down? You know, it's this kind of ugliness to me.
Yes,
that really
is
an obstacle to peace.
It is one-sided view of history, you know.
Yes.
So they'll point out that Yasser Arafat did, you know, this killed so many Israelis, maybe 10, 15, or thousands of people. But the fact remains that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were killed and became homeless, and their whole country, you know, did become non-existence, disappeared off the map because of the Israeli actions. They're not saying that because that's their view of history as returning to their homeland. and the Palestinians, you know, not a factor. They should not be existing. And there are some voices within the Israeli establishment, historical establishment, academia, that, you know, try to find out the truth as to what happened to the Palestinian people historically. Now, it is the fault of the Arabs and the Palestinians not to be more active in pointing what happened to them as a historical injustice and let the world know. Because, you know, if we write to ourselves about these injustices, you know, that's great, but that's not enough. I think the fault lies within the Arab and the Palestinian establishments for not highlighting what happened to them in the international media. And this is critical, in my opinion, and I'm sure you agree with that, because you and I have been doing this for 20 years, trying to highlight what happened to the Palestinian people to a Western audience, because they need to know, and everybody needs to know the truth and to what happened to the Palestinian people. And that's why the Israelis are more successful in this, in pointing their side of the story, while we not projecting our side of the story the way it is, the way it happened to a Western audience.
Yeah. And I tell you that I think that this guy, I think Israelis, really, if they really care about peace, there's no place for a vicious hater like Lenny Ben David in the media. He's no different than any of the vicious ugliness that poisons, you know, the hopes for peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Now, let's, in a similar vein, in February, Anthony Shadid, who is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, who we both knew, you know, very well. He was a member of our Arab Journalists Association. He died, and there were many people just assumed that he died on February 16, 2012, because as the New York Times reported, he had asthma crossing into Syria. But now, this past a couple weeks ago, at a ADC dinner in Washington, D.C., his cousin, Edward Shadid, said that before he died, he had a conversation with the New York Times, arguing with them, saying that he shouldn't go into Syria because it was too dangerous, and that he told his wife that if they forced me to go into Syria, that if I die, you should make sure that the world knows that the New York Times killed me. Those were his words. I want the world to know that the New York Times killed me. What do you make of this controversy, and why is it that nobody in the media cares about it?
Well, we know that Anthony Shadid, you know, said these things because he sensed that there will be a great danger to his life if he goes to Syria. So what he meant by that, obviously, that, you know, he was sent, you know, against his wishes, to a dangerous place, that if he dies there, it will be the responsibility of the New York Times, who put him in this kind of danger.
Is there a conspiracy, though, not to explore this? I mean, the only real people picking it up are some blogs. No major media has picked up this story, except in Oklahoma City, where his family is originally from. The local papers did stories about it. But, you know, even none of the Arab organizations, it's almost like, you know, they just don't care.
Exactly, because, you know, the guy's dead, unfortunately and sadly, and it's just the nuance of how he died and nuance of before he died, the argument with the New York Times, and New York Times being New York Times, because this newspaper sets the mode in the country of how reporting should be, what the news should be reported, and how it should be reported, and what news should be on the front pages of the U.S. newspapers. So Anthony Shadid, you know, have written for this newspaper, was an employee, and to blame the New York Times for his death, it will be a monumentous event in the U.S., you know, journalism history.
Right, a justice that'll never happen, though.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
So I think a lot of newspapers would probably be reluctant to demolish this iconic newspaper and blame it for the death of one of its reporters. So I think this is why, you know, not too many newspapers, you know, would go venture into that, you know, minefield. That's one. Number two, I think Anthony Shadid, being an ethnic Arab and covering an Arab event, it's not as romantic. It's not as, you know, something that all the newspapers will come and uncover it. You know, who would not be a hero who died in uncovering something that's so dear to the American public, you know? So he died covering something that's so dear to the Arab audience, but not so much for the American audience. So this is, you know, maybe perhaps a factor that why not so many American newspapers or investigative reports would try to find out the truth as to how Anthony Shadid died, whether by asthma or by a heart attack, as we found out later.
Yeah, I think that it is an important journalism story. I don't believe it's a issue of anti-Arab racism. Anthony Shadid was Lebanese-American, mainstream. He was an intern at ADC. He was active in the American Arab community. It was a great writer, obviously. He won the Pulitzer Prize twice excelled in journalism, was a great role model also. But what is disappointing is that journalism aspect, that this is a story. And no matter how we like a story, we should always investigate it. And the New York Times, I understand they don't want to embarrass themselves the way they embarrass everybody else with their reporting. They won't live by their own standard. But I do expect other media, you know, to say, hey, this is a story, let's check it out. And yet we can't even get that kind of story. And I think that's where the bias comes in. That if this were Tom Friedman, every media in the country would be writing about this. But because it's Anthony Shadid, and he was Arab, you know, they don't think it's worth looking into. That's my feeling about it. And it's another example of bias in the mainstream Western media, in my opinion.
I like Helen Thomas. You know, our friend Christine Tatum, published in her Facebook page about Clarence Page going to a rally in Paris for the Mujahideen group, the opposition to Iran.
One of the Iranian extremist groups that the U.S. says is a terrorist organization.
And Clarence Page got paid $20,000 to give a speech. I mean, I will do it for like $2,000.
Now, Clarence Page is a good guy. I really like the guy. He's a great journalist. But you're right, it's an interesting phenomena. And I think Christine was making the argument that, you know, there is some kind of bias here.
Yes, because look what Helen Thomas did. She got paid nothing, you know, to say what she said. And what she said was, you know, was taken out of context.
And she was excessively brutalized by the media, court of media opinion.
Yes.
Whereas Clarence, I think, and rightly so, I mean, I don't think Clarence or Helen Thomas should have been attacked. And I think Anthony Shadid's death should be reopened and investigated. But you're right, there is a bias, obviously, and we see it in many different ways against Arabs.
That's true, and I think we have a long way to go. I mean, you can't be more American than Anthony Shadid was. He's an all-American kid. He learned Arabic, and they always highlight that. He learned Arabic, you know, at an old age, that it wasn't his first language, you know. So even at that, you know, how much more American you need to be respected as an Arab?
No, we can never be American enough as Arabs. We won't be accepted, and that's a tragedy, and that to me is why terrorism still exists in this world, because the people that are against terrorism will do everything they can to isolate and punish the Arabs and treat us unfairly. Listen, let me ask you finally about this. This is just a hilarious video clip on YouTube. A Jordanian member of parliament pulled a gun on a political activist during a furious live debate on Jordanian TV last Friday. The member of parliament was Mohammed Shawabka, and he was arguing with a political activist named Mansour Saif al-Din Murad. And the host of the program was Mohammed Habashna. He was seated in the center, and you saw it. What were they yelling about? I mean, did you could, obviously it was in Arabic. What was the argument about? Do you remember?
Well, that segment, there was no argument. They were cussing each other out.
Oh, they were just calling each other names.
That's it. I mean, that was the whole thing. And the host, of course, you know, mimicking Al Jazeera, famous Faisal Al-Qassim, you know, it becomes like more a trend in the Arab world. You know, it is sad that we cannot even have a discussion. I have to, you know, cut somebody out. I have to call in names, and the host is like a referee.
Right.
That's a joke. You know, that's,
I mean, they just kept accelerating. You know, one would call the other person a Mossad agent, and, you know, of course, the Mossad is the worst thing you could be called, you know, in the Middle East, a Mossad agent.
Yeah.
And then the other one would say that you're a low life, and they went back and forth like that. But when the one, this is a minister, you know, a member of parliament, you know,
and
in the Jordanian government.
And with the other guy, the political Mansour Saifuddin, was a former member of parliament.
Ah, so, and he was a former member.
He was a former member of parliament. He's from the Circassian community. I believe he's a good guy, but, you know, he shouldn't be, you know, calling the other person names and the other person responding to that. He
well, it's hard to know who started it. It is hard to know what it was.
Yeah, we
what
don't know because, well, you see the clip that they fight each other out and they call him, you know, you support Syria, you don't support Syria.
Right, and the Syria, doesn't this symbolize the divisions that the battle over Syria have caused in the Arab world? Because the Arab American community is divided over Syria. The Arab world is divided over Syria. Syria has really become a point of contention. It may be the end of the Arab Spring. I think Syria may have pulled the plug, the electrical current fueling the Arab Spring through the Middle East, which is why I think many of the Gulf State Arabs want Syria, you know, to be the focus, because it really does overshadow the Arab Spring in terms of other Arab countries, you know. So it was interesting. But the best part of the video, I think, and if people haven't seen it, they should go on live on YouTube and look up Jordanian member of parliament. He got up and he threw his shoe. He grabbed his shoe and he threw it at the activist, the former member of the parliament, Mansour Saif al-Din Murad. And then Mohammed Shawabka, after he throws his shoe, the other guy falls and knocks over his desk. The host is getting up, this poor guy. Can you imagine, you know, being in the middle of this? And then the minister or the member of parliament pulls out a silver revolver and waves it in the air at the guy. I mean, just, I've never seen that.
It is a joke. And the Shawabka guy, he said, well, the reason I did that, because he called my father names and because he insulted the Mukhabarat, the security agency. So this member of parliament, instead of representing the people of his district that right. elected him to office, he says, well, I'm defending the security agencies,
right.
the police. So in other words, are you a member of parliament on behalf of the Mukhabarat?
Or the Mukhabarat, yeah.
Or the people.
Right.
And this is a problem. There's another guy named Yahya al-Saud in Jordan who's a famous, he's a nutcase, that he does the same antics, uses the same tactics. He yells and screams. He attacked the French news agency in Jordan. I mean, you have hoodlums as member of parliaments in Jordan, and they are pro-government. So in other words, the government of Jordan is represented by hoodlums, gown-touting, you know, individuals who say that they will die for the government. And these guys are nutcases. You know, they should be investigated for pulling guns, for doing criminal activities, attacking offices, attacking people. On behalf of government, they say we are the vanguard of the government and its security apparatus in Jordan. That's what they are saying.
Right.
And
now,
this makes the Jordanian government looks bad.
Now, this is kind of an exception to the rule. We don't always have these fights on TV where a guy pulls a gun, throws a shoe, and pulls a gun. But isn't this exactly the kind of stereotype that they're falling into, portraying the way we're portrayed? As hotheads, we can't control our emotions. I mean, what does it say about two elected, you know, and a former elected leader on a TV show that they can't even have a discussion, even if the guy said the Mukhabarat was bad? You know, they can't even tolerate a discussion, that they have to pull out a gun and threaten somebody? Why is it that we turn to violence as the answer to every debate we have?
Yeah, I tell you, the two stories, right? Well, first, I think this comes with Al Jazeera show the opposite direction. I wrote a column on that, you know, maybe six years ago, and I criticized Al Qasim for having this kind of show that it's more entertainment about, you know, violent reactions and a shouting fest between each other and cussing each other out and nationalities. And it's an entertainment. No one learns anything from this kind of show, and it becomes a trend. And this, what happened with the Jordanian MP, you know, it's an exact copy, but with a gun being pulled and a shoe being thrown. This is sad because, you know, it represents a low point in our media, that it does not foster debate, a civilized debate, that we could disagree with each other, but we could actually have a different opinion, but would still be civilized and respect each other. Second thing, I called a show that by our friend, an Arab American guy in Louisiana. We don't want to mention his name on TV. Right. That he was, and I listened to his show one day, one night I was free, so he put on his page that, you know, I'm going to be on the show. And he was talking about all kind of conspiracy theories about the Arab Spring, about Mahmoud Morsi, that he's a Zionist. So I called him. I said, well, I was trying to refute what he said. Said he won by 1 million vote. Let's respect the choice of the Egyptian people. He won fair and squarely. And he says, well, no, it was a Zionist that he put it. And you know what he said? He said, well, obviously you and I were not seeing eye to eye, and he got on the phone on me.
And I was having, well, I'm going to hang up on you, Allie. No.
You know, I mean, I was shocked. You know, this guy had a talk show.
But isn't that, we do have that in our community. We do have a lot of extremists, and I think that we need to divest ourselves from extremists.
Right. I mean, this guy is a talk show host. You know, if you disagree with him, he'll hang up on you.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I know they have this in the U.S. too. They have crazy people in the U.S., extremists in the U.S. They have them in Israel also. But you're right. There seems to be a low tolerance for differences of opinion. And Allie, listen, we've kind of ended. I'm looking forward to doing this again with you with some of the topics in the future. So thanks. It's a lot of fun.
Same here.
You've been listening to The Opinion Makers with Allie Yunus and Ray Hanania. Allie Yunus is an award-winning writer and political analyst based in Washington, D.C. He writes a regular column for the El Arabiya Arabic News Channel's English language website at english.elarabiya.net. Ray Hanania is an award-winning columnist and radio talk show host based in Chicago. He writes for the Saudi Gazette and Creator Syndicate. Reach him at radiochicagoland.com.